Iran's foreign minister is in Pakistan on an official visit. He says the two countries are opening a new chapter in bilateral relations. U.S. stocks take a plunge after the Fitch Ratings Agency downgrades the country's credit rating over fiscal deterioration and the government's rising debt. And Niger's junta rejects international sanctions imposed on the country as illegal and inhumane, vowing not to bow to threats to reinstate the ousted president. Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News. Iran's foreign minister says that Tehran and Islamabad are opening a new chapter in ties following a recent meeting between the Iranian president and Pakistani premier. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remarks upon arrival in Pakistan's capital on an official visit at the invitation of his counterpart, Bilawal Bhutto Zardari. He added an economic delegation from Iran has already arrived. Amir Abdollahian said he'll discuss the two countries' relations in politics, economy, trade, and tourism with high-ranking Pakistani officials. Iran's top diplomat said existence of numerous commonalities between the two allows them to further expand relations. He added during his meetings with Pakistan's top officials, a timetable will be drawn up for the Iranian president's visit to Pakistan.
A high-level delegation led by Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister for Economic Diplomacy, Mehdi Safari, arrived in Islamabad on Wednesday for a two-day official visit. The Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister participated in an important meeting where high-ranking officials from Pakistan and Iran engaged in discussions to actualize a series of pivotal development projects, fostering stronger ties between the two neighboring nations. The two sides discussed the barter trade mechanism between Islamabad and Tehran. In addition to exploring avenues for bolstering economic cooperation and promoting free trade, the officials placed particular emphasis on the barter markets, custom relations, and various other agreements reached in the 21st Joint Economic Commission of Iran and Pakistan, which was held in Pakistan last year. Following the meeting, the Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister told Press TV that both nations are resolute in their decision to broaden mutual cooperation across diverse sectors, including trade, energy, transportation, health, and tourism.
We have concentrated to increase the bilateral. Bilateral trade, this is not just making the business, also to joint production. This is very important. We have going to create a common free zone in the borders and to have not just for the trade, also to create factories in the areas of the medicines, just medical equipment and the other stuff which is needed for both sides.
A top official from Pakistan's Economic Affairs Ministry said the discussions primarily focused on exploring opportunities for augmenting trade, investment, and technical cooperation across multiple sectors. The areas of focus included energy, agriculture, infrastructure development, manufacturing, and technology.
This is an extremely important forum because we will soon be holding our Joint Economic Commission, which is the forum for resolution, discussion, and agreement on joint outcomes, and we will be holding that Joint Economic Commission in Tehran soon. So this meeting will go a long way in setting up the agenda, in reviewing the progress, reviewing the implementation status of the agreed actions.
Both sides have acknowledged the significance of enhancing bilateral trade volume and have pledged to foster an enabling environment for their respective business communities, unlocking vast opportunities in economic cooperation.
Although Islamabad and Tehran are working to improve their bilateral ties through a variety of diplomatic channels, economic experts believe that two sides can further increase their trade by easing up on their respective restrictions and giving each other better market access. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps started military drills in the Persian Gulf to increase readiness to defend Iranian islands. Maneuvers are also aimed at demonstrating the IRGC's naval power, as we discussed earlier with our guests in our news review program.
All right, this is the news review of the program. Let's discuss this a little bit further with our guest. Joining us is Masoud Shajari, political commentator from London. We also have George Samioli, senior research fellow at the Global Policy Institute, who joins us from Budapest. Welcome to you both. I'll first start with you, Masoud Shajari. When it comes to these three islands, what's happening here is UAE in particular is trying to disregard history, and it's trying to detach itself from what the reality on the ground is. And then you have others who have also said this should be open for discussion. Iran says there is no discussion. This is part of Iran, period. Why is it that this subject then recurs, whether it's from the UAE and then out in the open with anybody else that comes into the picture saying that it should be discussed?
Well, basically, we are talking about opportunism by some powers and those who want to create conflict, and they want to fuel conflict and sort of create instability in that region. And this has been one of the sort of the tools that they have used. The reality, as you said, is that this has been part and parcel of territory of Iran. And indeed, even before the creation of UAE. So really, there is no historical reality to this. There is no reality under international law. And it goes on and on. There is an opportunism by the UAE, but I think it really did. One of the greatest reasons for this is it serves the purpose of those who want to create conflict in the region, especially in the Persian Gulf region. So they will actually justify their presence, justify their interfering. Militarily, politically, in that region. And I think they need a conflict. And this is only serving that purpose.
To go along with that train of thought, George Samioli, even though that's a stretch, and it shows how desperate foreigners outside countries may be for there to be a conflict, they're hanging on to this particular issue. Iran has issued a stern warning, a repeated one, that says foreign forces are not welcome in the region because when it comes to the security and stability of this area, we can handle it, along with the regional countries, especially now that Iran and Saudi Arabia have warmed up to each other in terms of their foreign policy. What's your reaction to the way Iran's stance when it comes to this?
Well, it's clear that Iran's claims to these three islands is far more substantive and far more grounded in history and international law than the claim of the United Arab Emirates. To be honest, I've never fully understood what was the basis of the UAE's claim, because it had been a part of the Persian Empire for centuries. It then became a part of Iran, or at least under Iranian occupation. And so the UAE's claim seems extremely dubious. I mean, it's obviously strategically extremely important because, of course, the Straits of Hormuz are strategically very important. But it's also hard to see how the UAE can make good on its claim. I mean, it's not any kind of a serious military power. It cannot possibly confront Iran. And it's hard to see how any power is going to come in on behalf of UAE to challenge Iran. Certainly Saudi Arabia isn't going to do it. So it's not immediately obvious to me why the UAE is pressing this, or even why the Gulf Cooperation Council is pressing forward with a claim that is obviously very weak historically and legally, and it's a claim that they're not going to be able to enforce militarily.
Thank you so much for that. George Samioli, senior research fellow at the Global Policy Institute, and thank you, Masoud Shajari, political commentator from London. Thank you to you both. And with that, we come to an end for this news review.
Renewed clashes between Palestinian factions at a refugee camp in southern Lebanon have left at least two people dead. Those killed in Wednesday's clashes were members of the Fatah party. Several others were also injured following explosions that rocked the Ain al-Hilweh refugee camp near the southern coastal city of Sidon. Casualties include civilians. Palestinian sources say fighting factions used rockets and machine guns. Fighting first flared Sunday after a Fatah commander was killed in an ambush, and before the new flare-up, the camp saw relative calm after a ceasefire was declared 2 days ago. Clashes have so far left 12 people dead and 30 injured. Some 400,000 displaced Palestinians live in 12 refugee camps in Lebanon. Camps mainly lie outside the jurisdiction of the Lebanese security forces. U.S. stocks have taken a nosedive after the Fitch Ratings Agency downgraded the country's credit rating by a notch from AAA to AA. On Wednesday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 1%, while the broad-based S&P 500 dropped 1.4%. The tech-rich NASDAQ Composite Index tumbled 2.2%. Fitch attributes the U.S. credit rating downgrade to expected fiscal deterioration over the next 3 years and the government's growing debt. This is the second time a major ratings agency has lowered U.S. rating after the S&P made a similar move back in 2011. Secretary of the Treasury Janet Yellen has criticized the downgrade, calling it entirely unwarranted. She claims Fitch has ignored improvements in governance metrics and under the Biden administration and the country's economic strength. Former U.S. President Donald Trump is facing an escalating series of legal challenges with criminal charges brought against him now a third time in just 4 months. We have more for you in this following report.
For the first time, America is set to put on trial a former president in one of the most consequential criminal cases in the country's legal history. Ex-President Donald Trump has faced criminal charges for a third time in 4 months.
Today, an indictment was unsealed, charging Donald J. Trump with conspiring to defraud the United States, conspiring to disenfranchise voters, and conspiring and attempting to obstruct an official proceeding.
The indictment pertains to Trump's efforts to overturn his 2020 election defeat to incumbent President Joe Biden. It focuses on his actions in the two-month period between his loss to Biden and the infamous riot in Washington, D.C. During this period, Trump vehemently denied the election results, repeatedly asserting that the votes had been stolen.
All of us here today do not want to see our election victory stolen by emboldened radical left Democrats, which is what they're doing, and stolen by the fake news media. That's what they've done and what they're doing. We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen. You don't concede when there's theft involved.
According to the indictment, Trump knowingly propagated false fraud claims and exerted pressure on state and federal officials, including Vice President Mike Pence, to manipulate the election results. When failed, Trump directed his supporters to stop certifying Biden's win. That turned into a violent attack on the U.S. Capitol, leading to a move that is described as an attack on America's democracy.
The attack on our nation's capital on January 6, 2021, was an unprecedented assault on the seat of American democracy.
Trump vehemently dismisses the case as ridiculous and maintains his innocence, refuting any allegations of wrongdoing. He even goes further to accuse the prosecutors of being politically motivated, claiming they are acting on behalf of Biden to meddle in the forthcoming presidential elections, in which Trump and Biden could face off again. The two are currently tied in polls. The Trump campaign has also asserted that the Tuesday indictment amounts to election interference. Nonetheless, this is not the only obstacle standing in the way of Trump's return to presidency. The Republican politician has already been charged in two other cases, mishandling classified files and falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment to an adult film actress. The charges that have significantly hit the former president's reputation among many Americans.
I hope he goes to prison for a long time. I think he deserves to go to prison for a long, for all the crimes he committed.
Donald Trump is now due to appear in a Washington, D.C. court on Thursday. He faces 78 criminal counts overall. These charges mean the ex-president have 3 criminal trials to attend in the next 12 to 18 months, complicating his second run for the White House.
Public confidence in the U.S. military continues to wane. New polls revealed Americans' trust in nation's defense agencies have hit their lowest in over 2 decades. And not only has confidence in the military fallen, but the U.S. has been combating a serious shortfall in recruitment. The fall in Americans' confidence in the Army comes amid a recruitment crisis that's endangered the country's preparedness. Most American youth are now reluctant to join the Army altogether. So what are the reasons? Leader of Niger's recent coup has rejected international sanctions, vowing not to bow to threats to reinstate ousted President Mohamed Bazoum.
The National Council for the Safeguard of the Homeland rejects these sanctions in their entirety and refuses to give in to any pressure from any quarter. We reject any interference in the internal affairs of Niger.
In a televised address, Abdurrahman Tiani described the sanctions as illegal, unjust, and inhumane. He said sanctions are designed to humiliate Niger and its defense and security forces. Now, this after West African bloc imposed trade and financial sanctions and even threatened to use force if the ousted president is not reinstated by Sunday. Bloc has sent a delegation to Niger to negotiate with the military officers who've seized power. West African leaders have said that they will no longer tolerate coups in the region. Now, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Guinea are currently run by juntas, while Guinea-Bissau has seen an attempted coup. Mali and Burkina Faso have warned that any military intervention in Niger will be considered a declaration of war against them as well. Massive rescue and relief operations are underway in the north and central China after severe floods are triggered by typhoon-induced torrential rains. The rains have battered North China's Hebei province since Saturday, with precipitation levels exceeding 500 millimeters. This is China's capital city of Beijing recorded its heaviest rainfall in at least 140 years over the past few days. According to locals, local officials, I should say, at least 20 people have so far died in Hebei province, and many others are missing. Thousands of people have been evacuated to shelters and schools and other public buildings in suburban Beijing and nearby cities. Local authorities in Hebei province say nearly 850,000 people have so far been relocated.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. 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 کتاب الله.
In the limelight.
Britain is facing a homelessness crisis, with a number of people living in temporary accommodation in England at a 25-year high. The homelessness crisis in the United Kingdom comes on the heels of a mortgage crisis, which has been brewing for some time. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. Figures show the record number of British families are being forced to live in temporary accommodation, with experts blaming a shameful lack of social housing. A special investigation by The Independent has revealed that a majority of local authorities had failed to build a single council house last year, as waiting lists continued to soar. Now, official figures show almost 105,000 households were in temporary accommodation at the end of March of this year, a 25-year high. This included more than 131,000 children, the highest level since records for that measure began in 2004. Campaigners slammed the government for failing to support the building of affordable homes and warned the time for empty words on building social homes had long passed. Matt Downey, chief executive of Crisis, said families were trapped in temporary accommodation due to the crippling cost of years of no investment in housing benefit and a shameful lack of social house building. Matt Downey added, "Not only do people not have the stability and security of a home, but they're often left to cope in just one room, with no facilities to cook meals or do washing," noting that households across the country desperately need more social homes. Paula Barker, the shadow homelessness minister, said the figures were a shameful indictment of the British government's record, which have devastating consequences for thousands of families and children. Of the 104,510 households in temporary accommodation by the end of March, a high since records began in 1998, 64,940 were households with children. Both of these figures are up by about 10% on the same period last year. Temporary accommodation is offered to homeless households who are waiting for their application for help to be processed and to be offered a settled home. We'll be right back. latest statistics come just a day after Britain's Minister for Levelling Up, Housing and Communities and Minister for Intergovernmental Relations, Michael Gove, claimed the government would slash red tape to address the housing crisis and allow shops, takeaways and betting shops to be turned into living spaces. The housing minister also pledged to spark intensive building in cities and change planning laws to allow more home extensions. Michael Gove's announcements were mocked in the House of Lords by Labour's Baroness Taylor, who stated, "With over 1 million people on social housing waiting lists and 7,000 social rented homes built last year, does the minister really think a few flats built over chip shops is going to solve the problem?" There is a huge need for affordable housing, and local authorities, who were traditionally big builders of social housing, have decreased the number of homes they built in recent decades. Analysis of government data by The Independent found that in each of the last 5 financial years, 2/3 of councils failed to build a single home themselves. In 2021-2022, 207 out of 307 councils that provided data to the government had not built a home in that period. A snap survey of district and borough councils in England carried out by The Independent also found that just over half of local authorities did not build a single home in the whole of 2022. As the latest figures were released, Polly Neat, chief executive at homeless charity Shelter, said, "The time for empty words on building social homes and overdue promises on ending no-fault evictions has long passed." Polly Neat added, "To end homelessness for good, we need genuinely affordable homes." Michael Gove agrees social homes are essential to solving the housing emergency, so it's time for his government to get on and build them. Riverside, an organisation which describes itself as the largest provider of accommodation for people affected by homelessness, described the figures as very worrying. The figures released by the Department for Levelling Up, Housing and Communities also show nearly 80,000 households face homelessness in England between January and March of this year, the highest figure since 2018. The charity Shelter said a major contributing factor to rising homelessness was the instability of private renting, with the loss of a tenancy now the leading cause. The British newspaper The Guardian has also reported on the same story. In the last year, 24,060 UK households were threatened with homelessness as a result of a Section 21 no-fault eviction, which allows landlords to repossess their properties without having to establish fault on the part of the tenant. This is up 21% compared to the previous 12 months. Meanwhile, rent prices hit a new record in the past weeks, with property website Rightmove recording that the average rent outside London had risen to £1,231 per month. The Salvation Army warned that unless the freeze on housing benefit is lifted, more families would lose their homes because of rent rises. Nick Redmore, the charity's director of homelessness services, said, "Today's figures show more people than ever are losing the battle to keep a roof over their heads. Unless housing benefits are urgently raised to cover the cost of rent, the homelessness crisis will only worsen." Between January and March of this year, 1,760 households were made homeless due to rent arrears, compared with 1,390 in the same period a year earlier. Households needing help from local authorities because they were homeless or threatened with homelessness by March this year rose 5.7% on the same period last year to 83,240. Of the 41,950 households assessed as homeless and therefore owed a relief duty help to secure settled accommodation by their local authority between January and March of this year, 11,250 were households with children, up 12.1% from the same quarter last year. Of the households in temporary accommodation in the first quarter of this year, 13,780 were living in bed and breakfast. This is up by more than a third, or 37%, from the same time last year. The number of households who were sleeping rough when they approached their local authority for help was up by almost a fifth, or 18%, from the first quarter of last year to 3,770 households. The homelessness crisis in England comes on the heels of a mortgage crisis which has been brewing for some time. The Bank of England hiked interest rates by 50 basis points to 5% back in June. The move has affected millions of homeowners in Britain as the interest rates on many mortgages are directly linked to the central bank's base rate. Tenants have seen their rent increase as buy-to-let landlords pass on higher mortgage repayments. Estimates suggest that the Bank of England interest rate hike would see 1.2 million British households run out of savings by the end of the year due to higher mortgage payments. Higher borrowing costs are not just affecting households with mortgages and other loans, but forcing companies to tread more carefully in their management of costs in a tougher economy. The mortgage crisis comes against the backdrop of slowdown in Britain's economy.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. Well, you are listening to Muslim Lady. I am Asma as your host. I have the honor to be here with you and with Sister Zainab. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thank you for having me.
And thank you for being here. Well, it's always a pleasure. Since we're talking about the holy month of Muharram, I'm very much eager to know more about that because, you know, we are in this month already. And getting to participate in those gatherings with an insight of how much of things I can get from these gatherings could be even more fruitful than just getting there with no intention and with no special will in your mind. We talked about the benefits of these gatherings. We talked about the lessons that we could get from them. And we have been through too many details, actually. Now, we want to talk about the process of crying that happens in there. And since we're talking about ladies, and these ladies have got these delicate hearts, and all these little parts of this story would make them feel like suffering too much, and then all this suffering would gather in their eyes like the tears. Let's just see, what is the story of these tears?
Yes. Now, the next part when you hear the narratives of Karbala, when you are in these majalis, is the part of is the performing matam. When you shed tears, it's a way to express your unity with Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his family. Imam Sajjad alayhi salam says that he who weeps for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, even to the extent of a tear, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will place him with Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam and his family. We again have another narration from Imam Baqir al-Islam. He says, every tear shed for Imam Hussein al-Islam and every sigh of grief over his tragedy extinguishes a sin and Allah raises his status, the status of the one who is crying by 100 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
So shedding tear at the Muharram gatherings makes us basically feel lighter, reduce depression.
As if we're feathers.
Right. So even like according to the scientific research, crying has many benefits for mental health. Like, you know, when you shed tears, you actually are releasing stress hormones from the body.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's this hormone, cortisol, which when released through these tears can, you know, lower your stress levels and you feel more relaxed. Mm-hmm. But it's not like you can say, I can shed tears at home, I can shed tears anytime, and maybe my stress levels will reduce. No, shedding tears with emotions.
Yeah.
When you hear a sorrowful story, you forget your own sorrows.
What would it's be different. A better emotion than just to be in those gatherings
exactly.
and cry for a great cause, such as the message of Imam Hussein and the story of Karbala?
When you're coming out of these majalis, these gatherings, you actually, now your body has released the hormones which are mood boosting, like oxytocin.
Exactly.
Then you have even endorphins, you know, they improve your mood, they calm you down, they reduce your emotional and physical stress as well. So even they can aid your sleep, you know, shedding tears in the month of Muharram.
Yes.
Even though, you know, sometimes you have these majalis, these gatherings until late night, but when you come back, you feel
Already sleepy.
Right. You feel like, you know, you feel very lighter and you can go to sleep without having those sleeping tablets.
Exactly.
So this shedding tears.
So this is actually the secret behind all those coming out of the gatherings. When we come out of it, we feel like happy, though we've been through too much of sadness.
Right.
Though
we've been heard that tragedy.
Shedding tears. We've been going through details of the tragedy, and then it touches our heart. It breaks our heart. We cry too much. We feel so sad from the depth of our heart. But at the very same time, just as the gathering and the recitation is finished,
you know why?
When we get out of it, we feel like everything is different. We're lighter.
You know why? I had this medical as my subject up to class 12. So I used to study that there's this parasympathetic nervous system that would get activated after, you know, a stressful event you have.
Yeah.
And then this helps you fall asleep faster and even better.
Uh-huh.
So that's why when you come out of these, even having a stressful event, you're lighter.
Exactly.
It aids your sleep. Your mood boosting hormones are released.
And I guess it's the reward of those gatherings that has been given to us by Allah himself.
You never know what's there in the store of
exactly.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for attending these majalis. So that's just a worldly thing for, you know, for a moment or like that.
So I hope everyone who gets to participate in those gatherings to have the advantage of all those fruitful blessings that might happen to them in those gatherings. And all those who do not have a chance, I would highly recommend for them to get into those gatherings and see what a different experience it is. Yeah, just like this, let's go for a short break and then be back. Yes, all these cryings and all this sadness that we go through in the holy month of Muharram are going to act like catalysts for our soul. As in, they would make you feel more of peace and more of even you would feel like a free bird, like you have been freed from all the entanglements of this busy life. And
right.
then you would feel like pretty much lighter than the way you used to be before that.
Yeah.
All these cryings are going to help your soul feel more peaceful, because then the connection between you and Allah and Imam Hussein alayhi salam is going to get stronger.
Not only that, there's one point that's very, very important that should be taken into consideration is that if you cry too frequently, uncontrollably, for no reason.
Yeah.
You know, because we are saying that crying helps this way. So if you're crying for no reason, if you're crying uncontrollably, if you're crying frequently...
For the worldly matters, then it would lead into depression.
It could lead you to depression. It may require medical attention.
Exactly.
So when we're saying this, you are hearing a tragic event of Karbala, which has its own miraculous effects. When you cry in those gatherings, the 90% of your tears contain stress hormones. That has been proved. And if you're crying, you know, unnecessarily without any particular emotional reason, any tragic event, you're releasing 90% of water from your body, not the stress.
Yeah.
So there's a big difference when you're releasing water out of your body and when you're releasing stress hormones out of your body. So coming back, you know, when you cry for Imam Hussain alayhi salam, this inspires us to follow the example of faith and piety. So, you know, kind of therefore shedding tears at the Muharram gatherings could be healthy and beneficial way of dealing with our emotions.
Yeah.
Because sometimes we don't have the mastery of dealing with our emotions. We learn, and women have to learn how to master their emotions and improve their mental health, because if you don't have the talent to master your emotions, you never know where you which
well
path you
experts
can
say when you literary experts actually say that when you listen to a tragic poem or a tragic story, the thing that happens is that through the cries and through the sadness that you have for that hero and for that character, you are going to let out all the sadnesses and all the problems of your own soul. So it's going to help you release yourself from all the pains that you yourself have. Now, this is a sort of a worldly story that we hear. You know, kind of very trivial stories that we hear, and we call them tragic and we cry for them even sometimes. Now imagine what would happen when it is the story of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and it is the thing that Allah himself has said, that if you attend these gatherings, then there would be too much of rewards for you.
Right.
If you shed even a small single drop of a tear, there'd
your
be,
degree will be raised.
Exactly. So just imagine how much of release would fill your soul when you just get into those gatherings. So before we get into more, let's go for a short break and then we'll be back.
Countless voices crying, mourning, weeping with grief and pain. Had I a sword, I would defend the veil of Zainab. Countless voices crying, mourning, weeping with grief and pain. Had I a sword, I would defend the veil of Zainab.
So we already talked about the benefits of crying and the rewards of crying in the holy month of Muharram and for the great cause of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Now, let's talk about the kids and the impact of this holy month and the kids.
Yes, so women, they don't attend the majalis all alone. You would see some kids in their laps, some playing
around.
Yeah,
there are always children out
attending.
There.
Yeah, many waiting for that, you know, food to be distributed in the end of the day. Even if they come for that particular thing, just let them, you know, they will learn with time. There should be lenience when you're teaching.
Yeah,
the kids.
And they would participate in all those helping staff.
Right. You know, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, teach your children three things. Love for the Prophet of Allah, love for his family, the Ahlul Bayt, and love for the recitation of Quran. And you would see in these gatherings, you're practicing this hadith.
Mm-hmm.
And also we have a similar hadith from Imam Hassan alayhi salam, who says, raise your children on three foundations: love for their creator, love for the Prophet, and love for his family. The Ahlul Bayt.
Yeah, so the same thing.
Yeah. So now we have Imam Ali alayhi salam again saying that be the best example for your children, for they learn more from what they see than from what they hear.
Yeah.
If throughout the year you're telling them, you know, you're lecturing them, they may not learn much what they see practically in these gatherings. You know, these gatherings in itself have a lot of... So the first impact it has on children is the education and awareness.
Yeah.
These majalis, these gatherings, do provide an opportunity for children to learn about the historical events, which would be very difficult for you if you're living in a non-Muslim society to, you know, explain those historical events for them. So, you know, surrounding the events that are surrounding the martyrdom of Imam Hussein al-Islam and the significance of this event in Islamic history could be very beautifully taught by attending these majalis. So they gain the knowledge about the principles of justice, the sacrifice, standing up against oppression. This education in itself helps them to build a strong foundation of their faith and understand the values and teachings of Islam. Then another thing that you can teach to your children in these gatherings is an emotional connection. These majalis, as we said, involve the recitation of narratives. When these narratives are there, they evoke those strong emotions. So children may develop a sense of empathy, a sense of compassion, as they witness the grief and the pain associated with Imam Hussein al-Islam and his sacrifice.
Yeah.
So these experiences can help them cultivate an emotional intelligence, which is
exactly,
very, very important,
yeah,
which no institution can provide outside. So they develop a deeper understanding of human suffering, and they foster a great sense of empathy towards others.
Yeah, and at the very same time, they start questioning everything. They would ask questions, and according to those questions, they would get proper answers from their parents. So at the very same time, they're going to have that connection with their, you know, that a spiritual connection would be started to getting built just as they grow older and older. And at the same time that they are gathering in those gatherings, they would have some friends. They would learn how to contribute with the gatherings, you
how
know.
How to distribute when
yeah.
you're giving them food and charity to distribute or to collect
exactly.
charity for
yeah.
the sick. They learn that sense of
yeah.
empathy.
So I guess unconsciously it has got many, many effects on children. Thank you, sister. And thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us. Until another session, I just bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/farstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/farstodayenglish.
in the limelight.
Italy's economy has shrunk unexpectedly. The second half of 2023 is projected to see a sharper production drop compared to other Eurozone majors. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, Italy's economy underperformed expectations in the second quarter of the year, according to data released by National Statistic Bureau, ISTAT, recently. The country's gross domestic product dropped by 0.3% quarter-on-quarter, although it was up 0.6% compared to the same period a year ago. The bleak data comes in contrast with Italian government forecast of 1% growth for the entire 2023 and a modest expansion of the economy in the second quarter. Meanwhile, economists polled by Reuters projected Italian GDP finishing the second quarter with a flat reading quarter-on-quarter and 0.9% annual growth. Franziska Palmas wrote in a report for Capital Economics seen by the news agency, Italy is no longer outperforming its peers and we think it will experience a sharper drop in output than other Eurozone majors in the second half of 2023. ISTAT gave no numerical sector breakdown of its preliminary second quarter GDP reading, but said industrial and agriculture output decreased, whereas services grew marginally. The Bureau added that 0.3% decline left the EU's third biggest economy with so-called carryover growth of 0.8% in 2023, assuming flat growth in the remaining two quarters. Earlier this month, the government said that GDP could grow by at least 1.2% this year, citing a positive trend in services, buoyed by a prospering tourism sector, and that this would manage to counterbalance a slowdown in the manufacturing. According to ISTAT, annual inflation slowed to 6.4% in July from 6.7% in June, based on EU harmonized consumer prices, while growth in prices of food, household and personal care stood at 10.4%, broadly in line with the month before and over 50% above the overall index. Reuters also reported Italy's economy performed surprisingly poorly in the second quarter. Data showed recently offering an uncomfortable outlook for Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni as her government tries to tackle the negative impact of high inflation. Gross domestic product GDP contracted by 0.3% on a quarterly basis between April and June and was up 0.6% year-on-year, National Statistics Bureau ISTAT said. A Reuters analyst survey had pointed to a flat reading quarter-on-quarter and a 0.9% yearly rise. The gloomy data makes it harder for the government to reach its stated goal of 1% growth rate this year, although the Treasury said the target is still fully within reach. Rome added it would continue to work to implement its EU-funded national post-COVID investment program and to bring inflation down. In a report for Capital Economics, Francisca Palmas wrote Italy was no longer outperforming its peers, estimating the country would experience a sharper drop in output than other Eurozone majors in the second half of 2023. The figures cast a shadow on the country's banking sector, where the top two lenders in Intesa Sanpaolo and UniCredit recently posted much stronger than expected earnings, helped also by low or non-existent, in the latter's case, provisions against loan losses. Istat gave no numerical sector breakdown of its preliminary second quarter GDP estimate, but said industry and agriculture output decreased, whereas services grew marginally. The 0.3% contraction left Italy with so-called carryover growth of 0.8% this year, assuming GDP would be flat in the remaining two quarters. In recent weeks, the Italian government has said the economy could grow by at least 1.2% this year, arguing that a positive trend in the service sector supported by booming tourism would be enough to offset a widely expected slowdown in manufacturing activities. Lorenzo Codongo, head of LC Marco Advisors and former chief economist at Italy's Treasury, said, "Italy is an advanced industrial country, and the weakness in industry is much more important than the tourism sector for the economy's health." Istat also said annual inflation slowed to 6.4% in July from 6.7% in June on EU harmonized consumer prices. Annual growth in prices of food, household and personal care stood at 10.4%, broadly in line with that of the month before and over 50% higher than the overall index. To help the poorest, the government hopes to announce a deal with supermarkets and producers to control prices of essential consumer goods.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.